So let's start. I'm Ed Howard with the Alliance for Health Reform. Thank you for coming and welcome. On behalf of our board, Senator Rockefeller, Senator Collins, to this program to examine the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act of 2010. Now, PACA doesn't exactly roll off the tongue, but, you know, who would have thought that HIPAA would have become a household word? So we still have hope. Today is the beginning of the fourth week in the health reform era. The controversy over the enactment of this law was exceptional. The post-enactment static, I would say, has remained substantial. But whatever the ultimate fate of this new law, and let us all remember that word is law, we all need to understand better what's intended for this act to do and how it proposes to achieve its very ambitious goals. Now, one thing that both the proponents and the opponents of reform can agree on, and that is that this reform law will, once it's fully in force, have an enormous impact on almost every aspect of healthcare in this country, from who gets covered and by what entity, how much it costs, how it's paid for, the quality of care, how it's delivered. There are almost as many moving parts to this new law as there are in the healthcare system. One respected analyst I talked to yesterday is putting together a detailed analysis of the steps that are necessary under this new act. She said she and her team have identified all of the actions scheduled to occur this year under the law. I want to speculate how many there are. Write down a number. 150 separate things that must occur under the Act in 2010, followed by a few in the following years. Hence today's program. We're hoping to give everybody a relatively objective overview of what's in there. That's the theme. Without necessarily resolving all of the controversies that still arise over one provision or other. Now, you may or may not like the excise tax on Cadillac health plans, but we want you to understand what it is and how it's supposed to work. We're very pleased to have as our partner in today's program the Commonwealth Fund, a philanthropy based in New York City that's been extremely active over the past several years in trying to explain various policy options to policy makers. The fund's commission on a high-performance healthcare system was talking about things like medical homes and bending the cost curve before almost anybody else knew what they meant. And few policy experts on this topic have been more in demand than my co-moderator today, the president of the Commonwealth Fund, Karen Davis, who also happens to be one of the country's most respected health policy authorities. So very pleased to have Karen with us, and let me call on you at this point.
Thank you, Ed, and thanks to the Alliance for Health Reform for sponsoring this, and I think kicking off what I'm sure will be a series of educational offerings to help people understand what's in there. But my thanks to the panelists who really have the expertise today to answer your questions. And that's mostly what we're about today, is just answering questions. So my role is to give you a view from the 30,000-foot level and leave it to everybody else to answer the hard question. So turning to the first slide, I think the basic bottom line is that this is a historic accomplishment.
I'm sorry.
It covers 32 million uninsured. It improves the affordability of coverage for millions of people. There's been less focus on some of the provisions, such as the elimination of the donut hole in the Medicare program, but also the creation of a new voluntary long-term care financing program to help people who are disabled maintain independent living in the community. The provisions that particularly excite me are those that begin to move the health system toward a more organized, integrated healthcare delivery system that provides better care for patients, more coordinated care so things don't fall through the crack, that reduce errors, improve patient safety, and eliminate a lot of duplication, waste, ineffective, avoidable services that are now rendered in the healthcare system. And in doing so, to help slow rising healthcare costs that are a burden on everyone in our society, families, employers, state and local governments, and for many of you concerned about the federal budget. So I think today's session is designed to foster understanding of what health reform is and isn't. Certainly there are, as Ed mentioned, many important provisions coming online in 2010. But I think it's also useful to try to identify areas of consensus and to identify ways of working together to realize the potential of this legislation. I always think of the bottom line in terms of both dollars and people. So starting with dollars, the Congressional Budget Office estimates that it costs about $940 billion to both expand Medicaid to those below 133% of poverty and provide income-related assistance, paying health insurance premiums and medical bills. But there are a number of offsets to that, including contributions by employers that don't cover their workers, from individuals that aren't covered. But more importantly, from savings built into the legislation that would generate $511 billion in savings over the period from 2010 to 2019, as well as new revenues on the order of $432 billion for a net reduction in the federal deficit over this 10-year period of $143 billion. I spent a little bit of time on that because I think there's a sense in the general public that it costs $940 billion, but without an understanding that that's paid for through a combination of changes in current federal programs and new revenues. Even more important than the impact on budgets and on dollars, I think the impact on the populations that will benefit from this legislation, most importantly, the uninsured and the underinsured who get better coverage and improved affordability. But there are also benefits as insurance exchanges are created of offering more choices and improving the stability of coverage. There are some immediate effects in 2010, such as the coverage of young adults under their parents' health insurance policies. But many population groups that do not now fare well in our health insurance system will benefit. Women, in terms of benefits and premiums, will benefit. But also older adults, disabled adults, as we move toward both a temporary high-risk pool, but then guaranteed issue community rating that make health insurance available at the same premium to everyone regardless of health status, and then the very important long-term care financing. A lot's been said about cuts to the Medicare program. In fact, Medicare beneficiaries are guaranteed. The basic Medicare benefits will not be cut, and they will experience improved benefits in terms of phasing out the donut hole and prescription drug coverage and covering preventive services without cost sharing. That's not to say that there won't be issues as we go through implementation. I think that's a lot of what we're about today. I have particular concerns about the period from 2010 to 2014. Congress acted yesterday and the President signed the COBRA extensions, but states are still in fiscal difficulty. It's going to be difficult for them to maintain the Medicaid program, and there are still going to be large numbers of people uninsured over the next 4 years before the major insurance coverage provisions kick in. And I think there's a particular concern about sustaining and restructuring the safety net of public hospitals, nonprofit hospitals that serve low-income and uninsured people, community health centers, other clinics that try to meet the needs of this population and how they're able to rise to the challenge during this period. The healthcare delivery system, there are many provisions in here to try to move us to a high-performance health system. I think all of us have questions about the primary care system, whether it will be up to the task, and how important it is to make sure that everyone has access to a patient-centered medical home. The Medicare Medicaid Innovation Center kicks in January of 2011. It's important that the potential of really rapidly implementing and testing payment and delivery system innovations move forward smoothly and begin to generate information on what really works to both improve care and slow the growth in costs. Capacity to implement is an issue both at the state level and at the federal level, particularly at HHS, although Treasury, Labor, and others have roles as well. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to others on the panel.
Great. Thank you very much, Karen. You mentioned that we will be doing a series of briefings. You get back to your office, you should have the announcement of a briefing on the Medicaid aspects of the reform bill, which the reform law scheduled for next Friday, and then on successive Fridays, sessions focusing on private health insurance and then Medicare. And then on Monday, May 10th, we're going to do a session with the Commonwealth Fund on payment reforms that are built into this new law and how they might affect the shape of the healthcare system. So keep an eye out for the notices of those meetings, and we'll try to be as respectful of your responses as we possibly can. Let me just do a couple of logistical things before we turn to our panel. You'll find in your packets some very important information, including biographical information, more extensive than you're going to hear from me about our outstanding speakers. There's also background information on the topic, but not nearly the volume thereof that you're used to in these packets, and that's because we're trying to save a few trees anyway by posting much of the material on a website, our website, allhealth.org, and we didn't run off hard copies for you, so bear with us as we try this new approach and tell us how you like it. There'll be a webcast and a podcast available for you to look at on Monday on KFF.org, a service of the Kaiser Family Foundation, and on the Alliance website in a few days you'll be able to find a transcript. Today, I hope you're going to use green cards to ask questions or the microphones that you see to ask questions. As Karen said, that's the principal purpose of this session. And when you fill out the blue evaluation form at the end, I would appreciate it if you'd particularly comment on the format that we're using today with more Q&A time and the shift in the materials from all on paper to some on paper and some on the web. So with all of that, let me get to what you came here for. We have a really knowledgeable group of panelists today with a very broad range of experience, and we'll look forward to hearing from all of them. First of all, Sarah Collins. Sarah is Vice President for the Affordable Health Insurance Program at the Commonwealth Fund. She's an economist, and she's the main author of several detailed timelines that are in your packets that lay out a detailed sequencing of the delivery system and the revenue and coverage provisions in the new law. So I can't ask for anybody more knowledgeable about some of the interstices of this legislation than Sarah Collins. And Sarah, I ask you to get us going on a good note.
Thank you. Thank you, Ed. I'm going to provide a very general and very quick overview of some of the major provisions of the Affordable Care Act and when they are scheduled to be implemented. The details of the provisions, as Ed mentioned, are outlined in the timelines in your packet and also posted on our Commonwealth Fund website. And these were a group effort at the Commonwealth Fund. I can't claim complete authorship, certainly, of the system and delivery system reform timelines. And the revenue, so the staff really did contribute to all the work that we've done. And I really look forward to hearing questions that you have in the Q&A. In terms of what the law is projected to accomplish on covering the uninsured people, Congressional Budget Office estimates that by 2019, the number of uninsured will fall from 54 million to 23 million. Of the 32 million newly insured, an estimated 16 million will be covered under, or estimated to be covered under the Medicaid program. Another 16 million will gain coverage either through the exchange or employer-based plans. Of the 23 remaining uninsured, about a third or more than 7 million will likely be undocumented immigrants. The remaining uninsured will likely be similar to our current situation, people who are eligible for Medicaid but not enrolled, or those who choose the penalty under the mandate or for whom the mandate does not apply. So key to actually covering 32 million people and hopefully moving beyond 32 million is to make sure that enrollment is really easy, that it's seamless between different sources of coverage, and ensuring the affordability of premiums and also the quality of the benefit package. The major reforms that have the most significant impact on reducing the number of people, uninsured people, don't go into effect until 2014. But starting this year, as Karen mentioned, there are a number of important provisions that will serve as transitions for people who particularly struggle to gain coverage. Beginning this month, states do have the option to move forward on expanding Medicaid to adults up to 133% of poverty. This would be at current federal matching rates, but it doesn't mean that that doesn't affect the receipt of the enhanced matching rate starting in 2014. But the increased FMAP under ERA is actually not available for this phase-in expansion group. In July, people with pre-existing conditions who have been uninsured for at least six months will be eligible to enroll in this new transitional high-risk pool program. The administration has invited states to submit applications by the end of the month to establish pools or build new pools or build on existing programs. In September, young adults up to age 26 can come on to their parents' policy if the policy includes dependent coverage. Also in September, small businesses with 25 or fewer employees and average wages of $50,000 are eligible for a 35% tax credit for up to 2 years if they contribute half of their employees' premiums. HHS is beginning the process for coordinating with states on an annual review of unreasonable premium increases by insurance carriers. This week, the administration invited comments on this provision. HHS will also begin requiring public reporting by health plans of the share of premiums spent on medical costs. HHS also requested comments this week on this provision. And as Karen mentioned, Medicare beneficiaries who reach the donut hole in their prescription drug coverage this year will receive a $250 rebate. Additional reforms go into effect between 2011 and 2013. Beginning next year, insurers are required to provide rebates to enrollees if their medical costs are less than 85% of premiums for large group plans and 80% for small group and individual market plans. The donut hole continues to be narrowed over this period, and the long-term care voluntary insurance program, the class program, is also implemented in 2011. The major coverage provisions going into effect in 2014 include the expansion in eligibility for Medicaid for all residents up to 133% of poverty, insurance market reforms, including no underwriting on health, state insurance exchanges. States are required to set up exchanges. They can partner with other states. They can set up sub-state exchanges, or the secretary can set up state exchanges if states decide not to set up their own exchanges, or if it appears that by 2013 they're not going to move forward on their exchanges. The essential benefit package will be defined with four tiers of cost exposure, premium credits for families up to 400% of poverty, and cost-sharing credits up to 250% of poverty go into effect. Small business tax credits are increased up to 50% of the premium contribution, and the shared responsibility requirements and penalties for individuals and employers with 50 more employees go into effect. There are a substantial number of payment and delivery system reforms in the legislation. I don't pretend to be an expert on these. Karen Davis and other members of the panel can provide a lot of detail on the context of these in the Q&A and the context of these in the Q&A. There are these two slides, however, highlight some of the major provisions. Beginning this year, Medicare payments to non-physician providers are modified to account for expected ongoing productivity improvements. In 2011, the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Payment Innovation is established, which will test payment and delivery system reforms. In 2013 and 2014, CMS introduces a new national voluntary pilot program on bundling provider payment for acute care episodes. And the new 15-member independent payment advisory board tasked with presenting Congress with recommendations to reduce cost growth and improve quality will also be established. And I think I'll stop there.
goodness. Okay. A whirlwind tour of the highlights. Thanks very much, Sarah. Next, we're pleased to welcome back Dean Rosen, who's now a partner in the D.C. policy firm Melman Vogel Castagnetti. Dean has a wealth of health reform experience on the Hill and off, including a stint for a long time as the principal health advisor to then-Senate Majority Leader Bill Frist, where he was the principal interactor with the Alliance for Health Reform, since Bill Frist was then the vice chairman of the Alliance. So, Dean, we're very pleased to have you with us, and I have to say that it's the first time I remember some speaker having slides that fit on one piece of paper.
You said be brief.
I think
okay. Is that on? Can you hear me? Okay. Well, thank you, Ed, very much for having me and the Commonwealth Fund for sponsoring this. And I do want to say, use 30 seconds of my time to say something that I think is necessary, which is that this is a very humbling law. this was a good opportunity for me to actually try to read through the law again, and even with a couple of weeks notice, it was difficult to do and even more difficult to understand. So I think it's certainly probably not for Karen and Sarah and Mira, but certainly for me a bit presumptuous to act as an expert. I think we've got a lot of folks in the room who actually wrote the bill, and at some point, given your questions, I'm probably going to see if there's anyone out there who can help us answer them. Well then it'll be a really interesting panel. But in any event, I'm gonna try to do it. I thought what I would try to do. Sarah's done a really nice job, and Karen, of highlighting some of the key reforms, and we can get into it a lot in the Q&A. But I thought what I would try to do is just in a couple of slides and in a few minutes, try to provide some context for how to think about, or at least how I'm thinking about, the major provisions of the law. And a few takeaways, and I think if I can sort of leave you with that, even if we aren't able to answer all of your specific questions or any of your specific questions, as the case may be, I think that may be useful in terms of providing some context. So I did try to sort of on one slide, and I apologize if these are a little teeny, you've got them in front of you as well, sort of highlight what I thought were kind of eight major areas, not all the areas in the bill, but eight major areas, and include sort of the top line. And with these, I think there's a few takeaways that I want to conclude on in my third and final slide. But one way that I think, you know, I sort of approach this as somebody who spent my bulk of my public career on the Hill is, you know, what are you all who are going to have to be involved in oversight and implementation going to have to wrestle with, not for the next 30 days or 60 days, but for the next several years? And there was a CRS report, Congressional Research Service report, that came out just in the last couple of days that said that the rulemaking under the bill could extend not only over years but over decades. So the one thing we know that President Obama was incorrect about last July was when he said he would be the last president to address health care reform. I think there will be many presidents in the future who will be dealing with the implications of this law alone. But first are the insurance reforms. And again, I'm not going to go through all these, but there are some immediate protections that go into effect very, very soon. Those are going to be, you know, important to implement. The expanded list of reforms in 2014. I want to come back to the mandate. Another thing Karen mentioned that has not gotten a lot of discussion, but the CLASS Act, a major sort of new national long-term care program as part of the insurance reforms, is part of this bill. I'm talking about long-term care reform for a long time. It's part of the law. The next bucket, and again, I think as you look at these, you can look at them as substantive program areas, and my slide sort of mixes substantive program areas. You're going to have insurance reforms. That affects one segment. You have major Medicare reforms. That affects another segment. Medicaid and CHIP reforms, another segment. But I think you can also look at this and tax reform. You can think about this through a number of different prisms. One is, you know, which committees in Congress are going to have continued roles in oversight. Another is which federal agencies are going to be implementing these. Another is which programs are going to be changed as a result of the bill. And another way to look at it is when you think about this section on employers and insurers is, if you're a staff member, a member of Congress, is who's going to be knocking on my door or emailing me or picking up the phone and saying, you know, how does this work, or I need relief, or can this be changed, or help explain this to me. So I think there's a number of different prisms. For employers, you know, we have an employment-based system, and so a lot of the insurance reforms will overlap with employers. We can talk about some of the provisions and how they apply to grandfathered plans, which are those that are offered in advance, which are a little bit different from plans that are not offered on the date of enactment. But I think, again, major provisions here, the small business tax credit, there's not a mandate per se that employers offer coverage, but there are penalties that pertain under the tax code to employers that do not offer coverage, or that do offer coverage and have at least one employee go into the exchange and take a subsidy under certain conditions. There's auto enrollment, there's elimination of waiting periods, and in many cases the insurance reforms that we'll talk about or that we have talked about apply to employers as well. I mean, there's also major tax reforms, some of it designed to fund the bill, increasing the Medicare tax for high-income earners, one of them. We talked a lot about the Cadillac tax plan, which doesn't take effect until 2018. But there's other things, too, that, again, haven't gotten a lot of attention, like limitations on flexible spending accounts. So beginning in the next tax year, for example, you can no longer use FSA account to purchase over-the-counter drugs unless you have a prescription for the first time. And in addition, the amount of an FSA is going to be limited. So again, you can see I'm just literally skimming over a couple of the things to spur questions and give you a framework. But again, major tax reforms. Prescription drugs, kind of the next category. Follow-on biologics, major reforms. Some changes in Medicaid rebates. We talked, Karen mentioned, the donut hole coverage, which will certainly improve Medicare coverage for prescription drugs. That's a big deal. A lot of Medicare changes as well. You've got in excess of $500 billion over the next decade in payment cuts, whether you call them cuts or reductions in the rate of growth. You know, there are a lot of people who may not view those as improved efficiencies, who primarily health plans and hospitals, some of whom agreed to these reductions, but a couple hundred billion dollars each in Medicare cuts to hospitals and to Medicare Advantage plans. There are improvements in Part D coverage, as I mentioned, improvements in prevention. Medicaid, a bunch of changes. Sarah and Karen are the experts on those. I'm not going to talk about those. But you can see just in these four or five or these eight boxes, the scope and the sweep. A number of things in terms of quality improvement as well that touch on the Medicare Medicaid program, but also setting up a national quality strategy and an innovation center within CMS. And finally, some workforce changes with regard to setting up an advisory committee, some changes to the graduate medical education slot distributions and other major public health programs. So the takeaway and part of this is this is a big law. This is not like reauthorizing the Ryan White Act and watching it be funded in the next year. This is sweeping in terms of your major changes. And it's going to take place over the next couple of days. Let me just quickly go through the last slides in the last 2 minutes I have here. I wanted to talk about, and I think it was Don Rumsfeld who said there's sort of knowns, unknowns, and known unknowns. We've got a lot of known unknowns as part of the bill. This law has been in place for less than 30 days, and there are already things. I say this not to be critical, but, you know, we all know that the law was passed in a way that was unusual. You know, the Senate bill was passed. We never had a conference, and a lot of times in conferences where you iron these things out, and some of that was done for procedural reasons, but this slide, I won't go into a ton of detail, but I wanted to highlight just a couple of things that I think those of you on the Hill have been grappling with, and my point is I think we're going to see more of these to come because we know that there are going to be these unknowns. There was a hearing that was scheduled in the House and then was canceled on this issue of Part D deductibility in the Medicare Modernization Act. We provided that the employer subsidies were tax deductible. This bill got rid of tax deductibility. And so under the accounting rules, the FASB rules, employers have to take under the law an immediate markdown. One other thing I would say that hasn't come up, and I don't know, but as I read it, for plan years that begin 6 months after enactment, some of the insurance reforms that apply to these grandfathered plans, again, major employer plans, ERISA plans, include an elimination of lifetime limits and limitations of some kind yet to be defined by the Secretary on annual limits. Well, I believe that those apply to retirees as well. So I think you could see in another 6 months some of these plans with large retiree populations having to potentially take another write down under FASB, but to be determined. There was uncertainty, as you know, in the last couple of days over whether the kids' insurance reforms were sort of guarantee issue or elimination of pre-existing conditions. That was sort of worked out in a letter exchange between the insurance industry and the Secretary. There were, another issue for you to think about. I mentioned the immediate insurance reforms. And again, I highlight these because I think they're the kinds of questions as staff that you're going to deal with that we've seen in just the first couple of weeks, and we'll see as this is goes forward and whether you'll have to make adjustments. But there are the Secretary has to impose limitations for her to define on annual limits for essential benefits under the Act beginning this year. But the essential benefit plans aren't supposed to be defined under the Act until 2014 or leading up to 2014. So another issue, again, you'll have to deal with. And I'm not going to go through all these. We can talk about them, the high-risk pools, the creditable coverage, and for TRICARE, which has already been changed, and some other things. It just shows you that there are, whenever you do these large bills, a lot to do. So my last takeaway is it's a wide-ranging bill. It's a public health bill, it's a Medicare reform bill, it's a Medicaid reform bill, it's a tax reform bill, it's an entitlement bill. The implementation is not going to take place in a short period. It's going to be spread out over a long period of time. Regulators are going to have a fair amount of discretion under many of these provisions in how the law is interpreted. It will not just be HHS. It will be a number of other different federal agencies. Given the fact that insurance reform is really been a purview of the states, both on the insurance reforms, on the exchanges, on Medicaid, that's going to, I think, require a lot of close cooperation between the federal government and the insurance commissioners, the governors in the states, and as this moves forward. There are some boards and other things that are yet to be appointed. The IPAB, for example, with Medicare reductions in the future, and other boards that I think the impact is uncertain. And finally, the congressional responsibility is spread out, as we talked about, over a number of agencies. So it's a big law. We probably can't do it justice in 5 minutes, let alone the remaining hour or so we have. But hopefully that provides a bit of a framework. So thanks.
Terrific. Thank you very much, Dean. By the way, not in your packets, but available on our website, and I'm sure on Dean's firm's website, is one of the best summaries of this bill you're going to find, organized by specific areas where you're going to have to deal with controversies, and I commend that to you. It's a very, very nice piece of work. Our final speaker is Neera Tanden, who is the Chief Operating Officer of the Center for American Progress, where she's been actually back for the last several weeks. Before that, she was the senior health reform advisor to HHS Secretary Sebelius, served on President Obama's reform team. She was the principal domestic policy official in the Obama presidential campaign, and before that, the policy director for the Hillary Clinton campaign, and the ledge director for Senator Hillary Clinton. So I'm sure some of you have seen her wandering around these very halls. And we're very pleased to have her with us today. She's about as close to an insider you can get who hasn't been sworn to secrecy. So we expect to hear all of the insider dope about how this came to be and what the administration approaches might very well be. Neera, thank you so much for being part of this.
Thank you. Not sure, is this working? Great. Thank you very much. I want to say a word about this phenomenal panel and one thing about Karen Davis, who did his work, and both of the groups sponsoring have done tremendous work to ensure that we actually got to a day that we passed this bill. I remember being in Minnesota with Karen during the transition. I was Senator Klobuchar asked me to speak, and there was a great deal of secrecy even in the transition, but at her insistence, an Obama transition official was sent, and that was me. And I remember at the time saying that healthcare was the president's or president-elect's number one domestic priority, and really hoping that would be true at the time. And I'm glad to report that it is true and has been true. And I was honored to be part of the administration as it worked on this. I will make just a few remarks, because as I've gone through this experience over the last year, I know most of the most interesting discussion is in the Q&A, but a few things I wanted to respond to about the thinking of the administration as we went through this process. I thought it was great that Dean mentioned that we didn't have enough time in this legislative process to go over things, because it certainly didn't feel that way for me in the weeks that we were dealing, even with the Senate bill, and dealing with this issue. And so just to step back very, very far, because I think Dean and Sarah, but Dean in particular, raised that there will be a number of issues that will be discussed and debated as we go. And I think when we started this debate and started the discussion internally in the administration, we had a very deep appreciation of the fact that we were dealing with a very large sector in the economy. It was the view of the administration that we are not reworking the entire healthcare part of our economy, but we are dealing with a significant element of the economy with direct impacts. And so we really looked at the experience of Massachusetts and learned a great deal from the experience of Massachusetts. And if you look at that experience, part of the success of the program is that there was a very strong legislative framework, but a lot of work happened in the administration of the legislation. And I think that there's a very strong recognition within the administration that, you know, you did not want to set out every detail of how this law would operate in the legislation itself, because you are dealing with a fluid element of the economy, and we want flexibility in terms of, you know, how the law should work. Obviously, Congress insisted, and we believe that the most fundamental decisions need to be made at the legislative level, but there is this tension, which is to ensure that issues that arise can be addressed and you don't have to come back to Congress. And so I think we all recognize that the legislation was really a framework, and that there is tremendous flexibility in how it is interpreted, and that is a very strong responsibility of the administration, and there is a strong recognition within the administration. I come from HHS. The Secretary had a very strong belief that we would have to, that the administration would have to work with stakeholders and with the American people and everyone interested in the law to ensure its success, because the passage of the legislation, while historic, was not the test of its success. The test of its success will be over the next months and next years. And so I think there will be a number of issues that come up. We've already seen some flare-ups around issues like pre-existing conditions. And, you know, that I think was actually a model of working with the industries affected to ensure that they're successful as we go. And most importantly, I mean, I heard this all the time, but this is, you know, the president recognized when he was working on this issue the entire year that his presidency would be judged by its success, not just in the passage, but in implementation. And I think you will see tremendous presidential engagement in the bills, in how the bill operates, and how, and he will, you know, work to ensure that people understand what's in this legislation and how important it is, and ensure that it is successfully implemented and that the agencies are working to meet their deadlines. And I know that, you know, Treasury and HHS are working doubly hard to ensure that they do meet their deadlines and that they have a very good open process. It is a very complicated bill, but I very much recommend that congressional staff, stakeholders, industry work with the administration. We really believe that the administration doesn't have all the answers, and that they need to know what's happening and how these issues will affect industries, and that we need your wisdom and guidance to do this. And so I think that the legislation obviously was contentious, but we hope, you know, I know the administration believes that this is hopefully a new phase now that the bill is passed, that there can be a real partnership to ensure its success, because it will not be successful without partners. And I'm communicating a message from the administration on that. I'm not being in it anymore, but I know how important that was to everyone when I was there. So I will end it there and ensure that we have plenty of time for questions.
Terrific. Thank you very much, Nir. If I can get my microphone back on. There we go. Well, we have now provided a lot of background at 30,000 feet and then somewhat lower.
Yes.
And now you have a chance to bring us down to a granularity level that fits your needs. Let me remind you, there are green question cards that you can fill out, hold up, and will be brought forward. There are microphones you can use to ask your questions orally. If you do that, I ask you to identify yourself, keep the questions as short as you can so we can get through as many as we can. And let me just take the opportunity to remind those of you on congressional staffs that we have told the folks in your state and district offices of the fact of these briefings, including today's. We'll be reminding them when the webcast is available so that they can take a look at it when they have a chance. And you might want to encourage them to do that, because if my experience 30 years ago on the Hill is any guide, there are a lot of people walking into offices asking questions about how they're going to be affected, that if you're a caseworker in your district office, you may not have a full handle on. So if you have some way of sorting out where to go to look for an answer, that's a good idea. So let's start. Identify yourself, and let's get into the questions.
And I'm John Green with the National Association of Health Underwriters. We're very interested in partnering with the administration to try to work out some of these knots. So these two questions that I raise are not in any way intended to be disrespectful, but let's start with something that's going to start right away.
We'll be the judge of that.
I love when that's the beginning.
With respect to the temporary high-risk pool,
mm-hmm.
Okay, so there are two glaring issues that I see, and the first one is that if you're in a state with a high-risk pool, you're paying, the new program will have bigger benefits, standard rates. So if I went out and did the right thing and I'm in the high risk pool now, I'm going to look at that other risk pool and say, I want to be in that one. So to me, that's a political problem. The second thing is the funding is rather small,
right.
Won't last till 2014. I don't know what happens when the funding runs out. Are the states going to have a maintenance of effort requirement? Will the carriers be taxed another assessment to keep it going, or do we get additional federal funding to keep it going to 2014? And the second thing is with respect to Class Act, our guys are agents and brokers. They sell long-term care insurance, among other things. We're not sure how to market it. So you can pay a premium 2011 for a benefit we won't know until 2012. And then you can't make a claim for 5 years until 2015 or so.
16, yeah.
So we're not sure how to proceed on marketing that program. Those are my two questions.
High risk pool.
So I will take a shot at some of that, since they seemed a little bit directed at the administration. So the first, I think we should all be clear of what the high-risk pools are and what they are not. And I think this gets to Karen's point, which is while there is a high-risk pool funding, you know, it is limited. It's $5 billion. I mean, if we could have solved all our problems with the uninsured with $5 billion, it would have been a much easier legislative process. And so, obviously, this is not, you know, this is not going to address the entire problem over the next 4 years, and that's why I think Karen's comment that there is a continuing problem of the uninsured over the next several years is particularly apt. And so I don't think that there was not an expectation within the administration. I cannot speak to Congress that that either states or the private sector or insurers themselves would have to step in and make up all the difference once the funding runs out or you face other problems. I think there is actually going to be a big problem in getting people into these programs in a short order. In terms of, I don't remember your other questions about the high-risk pool. In terms of the CLASS Act, this was an area that obviously had strong administration support. It was an area that had very strong congressional support. There are issues that have been raised with it. We have some time to address them, but there are challenges with this, and this is an area that I think, you know, as in every area, there will be particular, there will be particular efforts to reach out and ensure that we are addressing concerns as they go. And, you know, I did not manage the CLASS Act part of the bill, so I can't speak to the specifics, but I know overall it will be an area of continuing challenge. And if someone else wants
to. Is that you're enrolled through payroll deductions, and people are automatically enrolled unless they opt out. So the primary burden will be on employers to explain the program to employees.
Dean, you.
I just one comment on the risk pools, and I think the answers are to the technical questions, Neera, you know, would be better, and they're sort of unknown. But I think like the prescription drug card in the Medicare Modernization Act, it is driven by a political need to or desire to get people something immediately when the benefits of this in terms of the subsidies and the real coverage stuff are far off in terms of at least election cycles, right? They're two election cycles away. So it's always a challenge to do that. And like in other areas, you're building on existing systems. So I would say it's an area where, John, wherever you went and you asked the question, you're going to have to work with the secretary because there's going to have to be some creative interpretation beyond the law to make sure that, or within the framework of the law, just to make sure that people get the coverage that's there. And I think it's the one thing I would say with the drug card as an example is I do think it's important in terms of building confidence for those who want to instill confidence in the program for these things that come online irrespective of when an election year takes place to have the things go as smoothly as possible. We know that they're not all going to go smoothly, but I think it is really important that stakeholders, states, agents and brokers, insurers work with the administration on it because it's going to require flexibility to get it up and running. And there do appear to be issues of interpretation that are going to be really critical in the next 90 days.
Can I just respond to that, or do you want to say something? The one thing I would say about the high-risk pools coming from the perspective of the administration is this is an area that was a conservative idea, and the president wanted to bring in conservative ideas. And so we were not looking at the high-risk pools, I can say, as something that, was focused on election year politics or 2010 or giving something media. It was really, we were trying to address the problem of you have it takes a long time to get the exchanges up and running, and yet you have a problem in immediately, which is that we have a large number of uninsured people. And so that was where this idea came from and the energy behind this idea, because this idea was introduced. The president championed this in his joint address to Congress in September, and so it was one that came a little bit from the administration, but I would say that was an effort to be more bipartisan and bring in some of those ideas.
Sure.
And just on the issue of two pools running in one state, one maybe having lesser coverage. I think that those issues have not been worked out yet completely. And there is a provision in the bill that you have had to have been insured, had been uninsured for 6 months. Without creditable coverage. So the question about what is creditable coverage and how, and so you would think that those kinds of issues will be worked out in the months, in the weeks to come.
And let me just ask a question from a card that's relevant to the high risk pools, and the person would like to know how much of a dent this provision is likely to make in the number of uninsured. Is this a big deal? There are about, 200,000 people enrolled in the current high-risk pools the states operate. Is this going to make a big difference in that?
I think the estimates are that it could increase it. I mean, it could be as high as tenfold or something, up to 2 million people, I think was the CBO estimate. So it's whether that's big or little, I think that's the estimate. That's probably high given the funding and given the challenges of getting them up right away. But I think it's a significant increase from where people are in high-risk pools now, but not significant when you look at the eventual 32 million.
Hi, Tony Hausner, formerly with CMS, now independent consultant and also a volunteer with Organizing for America. One of the things that strikes me is the need more to acknowledge the incredible accomplishment that's been achieved with this bill. I don't think enough has been done to fully celebrate the accomplishment and the debt of gratitude we owe both the President, Congress, and all the other players that were involved in this. One of the things that concerns me is looking at the poll results that the majority of Americans want the law repealed. Now, maybe it's very early in the game, but we need to be cognizant of that. And I think it's incumbent upon the administration, Congress, and many of us to figure out a way to communicate to the public on what's in this bill. I think if the public understands it, I think that will help a great deal to turn them around. I think we've got to particularly tell them about not only the coverages that are in the bill, but like how it improves effectiveness, cost effectiveness of the healthcare system, and how it's really going to save money, because people don't believe it's going to save money. They think it's going to cost us more in the long run. And so that's one of the biggest selling issues that we've got to deal with. And I think my question, in a sense, is what are we doing? What thoughts do we have about trying to communicate more effectively with the public? We need to develop strategies to debunk some of the myths, so I'm interested in people's thoughts on where we're going with that so that we can turn the public around on, you know, their understanding of the bill.
Here we are, Tony.
Right. That's a start. Dean's paper, the papers that the Commonwealth are a good start, but we've got to figure out a way to get that information into the heads of the public.
Nira, you want to take a crack at that?
Sure. I mean, obviously, being inside the administration, you know, we recognize with great frustration the difficulty.
Your mic.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Can you hear me?
There you go.
Okay, sorry. I'm sorry about that. Being inside the administration, we recognize with some degree of frustration the difficulty of communicating about this legislation. And I would say, what was particularly interesting from a public policy perspective, I mean, I've worked on a variety of issues. I obviously spent most of my time in healthcare, but I've worked on others. And, I think if you step back, healthcare became the debate it did because it is an area that people feel, I mean, everybody is an expert on healthcare. You know, not everyone is an expert on financial deregulation, but everyone has a healthcare experience. They have a they understand what it means to go to the hospital or go to the doctor, and they care deeply about whether their child has access to a doctor or their mother has access to Medicare. At the same time, it is a very complicated area. Explaining to people what an exchange is and how you keep your insurance, but the exchanges really work for the uninsured, and what it means to, and really what it means to try and lower costs and how we are actually lowering costs in the legislation. And people have varying degrees of understanding of the payment system as it currently is, well, the way of trying to explain what a bundle is. And so, you have an area where people feel passionately, and yet it's very complicated, and I think that was a reason why it was relatively easy to demagogue. And we saw, things being said about it, which were completely false, death panels and the like. And I think what's great about this, moment is that we really have an opportunity, which is people's expectations are quite low about what the legislation will produce. And, you know, now we have the opportunity to actually show them how they benefit from the law. And I think what's particularly good is over... Oh, they're not working. I'm sorry. So I think what's particularly, I apologize for that, what's particularly good is that we have an opportunity now with what will happen in the legislation over this year to show actual results. And that's why it's particularly incumbent on the administration and its and the agencies to ensure that people have a good experience with the law in the first year and in the first period. But I think actually having tremendously low expectations is a good thing, and, you know, hopefully we'll have a debate as we go. One of the big things is a lot of these items go into effect in September, and so, you know, that's a good or bad thing. But they will we will be having a debate about the actual merits of specific benefits of the legislation in the fall versus the legislation writ large.
You know, you talked about costs, particularly, and there are a couple of questions here that relate to that that I wonder if we could try to talk a little about. One is directed to you specifically, Neera, because of your mention of Massachusetts as being a source of a lot of inspiration for the new federal law. Then you know, the questioner says, that Massachusetts did not build in cost containment and now costs are out of control there. Why did you not incorporate immediate cost control features? Go ahead.
Okay. I think what's great about the Massachusetts experience is, and what's difficult about it is that it's limited to a particular state, and we were able to learn a tremendous amount. But it is very difficult, or I should say it's more difficult for a state to address costs than it is for the federal government. And Massachusetts very self-consciously did not try to address costs in the legislation. I mean, the people who created Massachusetts basically created a coverage plan. And obviously the rhetoric around that was quite different. You know, I would say the tremendous challenge of addressing costs over the last year was that it's complicated. It obviously there are stakeholders who are directly affected by cost reductions. I mean, our debate about the IPAB board over the year was very contentious and very difficult, within the caucus, within the Democratic caucus. That is because you have stakeholders who are directly potentially involved. And we this entire debate from July to the passage of the bill took place against a conversation in the country where the attacks on the bill was that it was rationing care. So it was, there was a central attack made on cost reductions in the legislation. And so that focus made people, and I would say members of Congress and within the administration, made people feel sort of more agitated about cost reductions than they otherwise might have. At the same time, many members heard from constituents who were more focused on the fact that premiums were out of control than they were about coverage. And so you have this duality, and, I mean, we had lots of members who would say we have to cut costs, and that's the number one concern. But whenever there was a specific discussion of cost reductions, it became very difficult because stakeholders would go back to members of Congress and say, you know, you can't hit the hospitals too much, you can't hit the docs too much, you can't hit devices too much, et cetera. And so, you know, this was a legislative process. There was a big focus within the administration on cost reductions. The president talked about cost reductions. We pushed very hard internally for it, and, you know, within the Congress for things like an IPAB board. and our commission. And so I think that was a lot of the give and take over the last year. And I would say that there was a recognition within the administration that the president will be held accountable for cost savings over the long term. And so I think you'll see within, you know, I think there will be a big push to see, you know, more, you know, as aggressive action as possible on issues like payment reform and payment delivery reform, because those are areas where we recognize long-term savings have tremendous potential.
And that actually brings up another part of the question, which is to another card, actually, to ask for more detail on what's in there to hold down costs. And it brings to mind a couple of things that we came across in putting together materials for this program. One is something from Jim Capretta, who was a Republican budget staffer on the Hill for a number of years and is now independent, who talked about there being only two ways to control costs. Either you use government controls or you use the market. And his contention was that neither one of them was present in this bill. And on the other hand, Jonathan Gruber, who was very active in consulting with a number of the folks who put this bill together, who was quoted as saying something like, "It's really hard to figure out how to bend the cost curve, but I can't think of a thing to try that they didn't try. Everything is in there." We are awash with economists and people who are familiar with these issues. I'd love to hear the reactions on that issue.
I guess I'll start and probably say that I, not surprisingly, believe the truth's probably somewhere in the middle. I'd probably be closer to where my former Republican colleague is, but and I'm sure Nira would be in a different place. But I think that I think one thing, and I mentioned a couple of the specific things. I think one thing that is important, and I think Nira made this point, is that over time, substantively, I don't think any of us should be deceived into believing that that additional fees on industries or that, you know, just simply reviewing the rates that insurers charge and clamping down on them alone, which is part of what the debate is now in Massachusetts, is going to solve our long-term health cost inflation problem until we start to get at some of the underlying system reforms. I think we would all agree with that. I think Commonwealth has done an incredible amount of work in looking at system reform. So there are some offsetting things from a, you know, 10-year budget window in the bill that are payment reductions. There are other things that are fees that I don't think go to real cost reduction. I would say the couple things that are in there from my perspective that have hope that they could lead to real reform, probably not in the kind of, in fairness to Jim Capretta, market-based sort of competitive system that he would see, but at least hope that they would lead to the kind of value would be things like the Medicare and Medicaid Innovation Center, which has a lot of discretion to test and to pilot programs, to expand those programs nationwide, can do it without the current constraints under demonstration authority of budget neutrality, which I think is important. So the kinds of things that could get piloted and then moved out over the years there could help, and I think that would be important. I think, you know, whether you like it or not, there's a lot of controversy about it. You know, the IPAB clearly could help with cost reduction. As Nira points out, there's controversy around that, and that maybe that's not the right kind of cost reduction, but clearly that's one thing in there. I think that you know, for me, while I personally, just speak for myself, didn't love the way that the Cadillac tax was constructed, because I think it was there trying to approximate what a lot of economists have talked about for years, which is eliminating or capping the employer-provided exclusion. It nonetheless does help to constrain costs in the future by putting some kind of a cap on benefits, and it is pushed off. But again, that's another thing that coming in it is 2018, but all these things are movable and dialable, but clearly we'll have some some downward pressure on costs. So I think there are a number of things in here that have real potential. I think there are a number of things that are in here that clearly will. I would just say to all of you who are going to have responsibility for making policy in the future that I would look not only at things like increasing fees and just saying that insurers can only charge so much and say, oh, we've solved cost containment, without trying to look at these broader system reforms wherever you come out on the ideological spectrum about how best to achieve those.
Karen, you want to comment on that?
Well, I would echo Dean's point that we need to look at broader system reform, but I think there's a lot in here. For conservatives, the major strategy for cost control has been transparency and patient financial incentives. There's a lot of transparency in this bill, so people will be able to compare quality and cost. And certainly with the basic silver plan being a 70% actuarial value, with patients paying 30% of the cost, there's a lot of room for financial incentives for patients. But I would second what Dean said about the importance of the Innovation Center, the rapid testing of new payment models that move us away from fee-for-service. I would underscore the importance of setting up a system that gives us timely feedback on what's working and being there is authority then to spread it broadly within the Medicare program. But I think there's also immediate delivery on savings in the Medicare program through the productivity improvement provisions that really start in 2010, and then in 2014, 2015 with the Independent Payment Advisory Board, which will make recommendations on controlling the rate of growth in Medicare spending relative to preset targets. Congress has an opportunity on a fast-track basis to substitute an alternative, but one way or another, those savings will be achieved. And if the Innovation Center work that starts in 2011 can be linked with the recommendations of the Independent Payment Advisory Board in 2014, 2015, then we can achieve those savings, not in crude ways of just cutting prices, but really moving away from fee-for-service toward models of care that reward quality and efficiency. So I think there is a lot that's guaranteed to deliver savings, both in the private sector and the public sector. The Independent Payment Advisory Board is charged with making non-binding recommendations on the way that private payers can achieve savings as well and payment reforms that they can implement. So I kind of agree with Gruber on this one. There's a lot in there, but I think these are the most powerful provisions that are in there to really deliver on cost containment.
Sherry, you want to comment?
Just in terms of timing, too, compared to Massachusetts, a lot of these go into effect right now. I mean, we mentioned the premium review process, but also the medical loss reporting. So that process gets put in place right away with actually penalties for exceeding those loss ratios next year. So,
good. Tony, you have a quick follow-up?
Well, the concern I have, and I'm not sure we've talked about it enough, is I see the need for a comprehensive communication strategy, PR strategy, to say what's in the bill and what are the myths, and what do we need to do to ensure that all the key players are doing that. You need both written materials and you need to be out there speaking to the public, I'm not aware that that's been developed, a comprehensive communication strategy. So I'm wanting more thoughts on that.
I would guess that this is not the place for a communication strategy to be developed. We're part of what might be in that strategy if you're looking at fact-finding. But I think what we'd like to focus on is what are some of the facts.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So. Thanks.
Yes.
You'll have to bear with me. I get a little nervous. Sorry. I'm trying. But I'm a med student at Georgetown, a third-year med student, and hopefully future doctor as long as I pass all my classes. I'm there because I really care about patients, which we all are. I want to go into primary care. I love Obama because he did healthcare reform. I know it's not what he wanted, because I know that he's said multiple times he supports single payer, which I do as a future physician, because I think it's the only way we can get affordable coverage to everyone and save money. You guys are talking while I'm talking.
We can hear hear you.
Okay. Well, anyway, I'm like trembling, sorry. But the other thing that I care about also is tuition and making more primary care doctors. We don't have enough people going into it. One of the reasons is it's costing me $300,000 to go to Georgetown. So I have a lot of debt, and it draws people into specializing, and that's not necessarily what patients need, but you can see how it happens because everybody really cares about money a lot and not people, which is heartbreaking, really. I ended up having to take a break from med school because of all of that. But when I saw Frontline and Obama, how hard he tried and how exhausted he looked and how it just really inspired me. And I guess I was just wondering if you could say, you know, how much easier would it have been if we had a publicly, if the bill was saying that it would be a publicly funded, privately delivered system, and how much cheaper and better or worse, or could anybody comment on that?
Are you referencing single payer, like as a single payer plan, or?
Yeah, basically, publicly funded, privately delivered. I know that I'd heard Obama speak a lot about that's what he supported, and that's what I support as a doctor, you know, future doctor, and a lot of my other doctor friends, and I just want to know if you guys could kind of comment on that.
I mean, I'm happy to take the first crack at this. So, and I want to thank you for studying to be a primary care doctor, because obviously that's the backbone of our healthcare system, and we you know, primary care doctors do heroes work every day, and it's important work, and we'll need more of them when healthcare reform is fully operational. I was on Senator Obama's general election campaign. I was not with him in the primary, but you know, I've heard him talk about single payer, and what I think, you know, his view of single payer is that is something that if you look at what other countries do, it has been effective for them, but if you were starting all from scratch, which we are not doing, but if you were starting from scratch, that might be something you look at. But what was really important in this debate and a very central promise that the president made, and one he made on day one and the last day, is that if you like your health care, nothing changes. And I cannot overstate how important that promise was given the level of fear and consternation that was driven in this debate about things that had nothing to do with the healthcare. And so what that meant and what that promise meant was ensuring that we built on the system that we had. And from materials, you'll see materials that Dean put together, you know, basically the employer-based system remains untouched. Now, one could argue that there would be greater efficiencies in the system if you actually changed the entire system. But given the tremendous difficulty we had over the last year, I would argue that it was better to build on the system that we had. And, you know, I did not work on Hillary's plan, but Hillary Clinton is a good friend of mine, and I listened to a lot of war stories about that experience. And actually changing people's health care, broad sections of people's health care, was one of the reasons why so much fear and consternation was driven about that plan. And so, you know, as I have said in other places, this is a pragmatic bill. It is actually a centrist bill. It's built on Massachusetts. There are lots of Republican ideas in it, exchanges, healthcare tax credits. These are ideas that have come from a bipartisan group of healthcare economists over the last several decades. It has liberal ends. It will ensure that we cover, you know, according to CBO, 32 million Americans, and that we will be on a path. We will have a framework by which we can expand coverage from there. I have lots of friends who are single payer supporters and who champion a public plan and other issues. But I would remind them that this is the biggest, largest scale social policy we have done in 40 years as a country. And as the president has said, this was not just an issue of healthcare; it was a question about whether we could govern ourselves. And obviously passing the bill was the first part of governing, and now we actually have to prove that we can govern by actually ensuring that this bill works for the American people.
Dean?
I would just add really quickly I don't know about your particular situation, but there's a number of things I think that at least indicate that Congress and the President recognized the centrality, as Neera talked about, of primary care and the importance of it. There's, you know, I mentioned the GME slots. There's some grant funding and loan. There's an increase, at least for a time, in Medicaid reimbursement for primary care that would bring it up to Medicare levels. So I think there, yeah.
Yes, sorry.
Yeah. I don't think there's anything on residency work hours in the bill. It's, I know a number of states have addressed it, and there's some federal bills.
State issue. There's, I mean, that's being. Right.
But there are provisions that go to loan repayment and expansion of the National Health Service Corps, are there not?
Yeah.
Yeah, and also expansion of community health centers, too, a big increase in the budget.
I would also just make the point. I mean, I think this is one of those things where the, you know, whether it's privately delivered in government finance, it's sort of in the eye of the beholder. I think, you know, for a lot of people, it clearly doesn't go far enough. There's not a public option, as the case may be. But if you look at the 32 million newly insured, half of them are going to get their coverage through Medicaid, which is a government program. It's privately delivered in a lot of cases, but it is a government program, and a lot more organized and regulated through exchanges. Employment coverage is going to decline a little bit. The individual market is going to decline a little bit. So at a minimum, they're going to be more organized. There's going to be significant government funding, both through Medicaid and through the tax credit. So you can look at it from both perspectives. It's certainly not single payer, but there is, as Neera said, it's certainly a major social effort.
Actually, this is a cross-cutting question that weaves several elements that we've just talked about into the same inquiry. How will the expansion of Medicaid that Dean just referred to affect the new employer requirements? For example, will the auto enrollment provisions apply to workers who qualify for Medicaid? And will the employer penalties also apply to any full-time worker receiving Medicaid? Any idea?
I mean, as I understand, I don't believe the auto enrollment is the auto enrollment for employers is for employers. So when the employers offer a health insurance plan, one of the big issues is that a lot of people don't take up. There's an auto enrollment option. There's an opt out, but instead of an opt in, the law sets up the requirement that everyone is automatically insured, and then people who don't want to pay for coverage and that means can come out of it. Now, obviously, there's still an individual mandate in the legislation with hardship hardship exemptions. So there's obviously huge incentives to enroll if you're offered health insurance. But the auto-enrollment mechanism, as I read the legislation and as I understand the intent of both the administration and congressional committees and authors, was that the auto-enrollment provision applies to employers.
I think.
Is that your first?
Yeah, no, it does. I think there's a question on auto enrollment, which is it applies to employers over 200 in the bill, yeah. And but I think 200 full-time employees, FTE equivalents. But I think there are going to be issues to be answered in the regulatory process about if you've got to auto enroll someone who has other coverage, be it Medicaid or be it military coverage, to be sorted out. I think the intent was to get people covered right away, and so that is a question, but I think that's where the intersection is. The penalties don't apply. For an employer, the penalties would apply if you go into the exchange and take a subsidy, or if you do not offer coverage. They're not triggered, I think, by Medicaid.
Yes. Go ahead.
Hi. I want to introduce myself. I am Matthew Donnell. I am a third-year preventive medicine resident at Emory University School of Medicine. I'll be finishing July 1st.
And
we'll take my certification exams and go out to the workforce, probably the best time in preventive medicine in over 50 years. The sad part is that one out of every 50,000, well, one preventive medicine resident or physician at this point in time is trained to treat a population of 50,000. So that means we're producing one preventive medicine resident per population of 50,000. What I'm trying to get at is this, and first I want to applaud everyone who was part of making this legislation come true. We all have a piece in that. Whether we agree with it or not, we as a society have come to a step further saying that we have a right to see our doctor when we're healthy, where we can prevent a certain issue from happening. And that technology in medicine has advanced so much in the past 50 years, whether they're colonoscopies, getting a blood pressure check. I mean, in your parents' generation, I'm sure many of you could imagine we didn't have the technology or medicines to prevent that we have today. What I wanted to get at was this. I was looking at the timeline, and please correct me if I'm incorrect. I am a physician. I have an MPH, but I am not trained in policy as nearly as much as probably half this audience. And what I wanted to know is, I would say in, 24 months, we're going to, as physicians or the healthcare workforce, we'll be receiving a lot more patients, you know, through children, young adults who are going into parents' health plans, maybe tax breaks for small business tax credits and requirements for clinical preventive medicine services that they be covered so people will actually go get them. But one thing I wanted to ask was, how is there anywhere in this law that addressed in the short term, not the long term, but in the next 24 months, how are we going to address the shortage of trained physicians that can meet these needs? Mm-hmm. Not long term, and just so the audience understands, traditionally when one gets trained to become a practicing physician, you go through medical school, which is 4 years, and then after that you complete an internship in medicine, which is 1 year, and at that point as a U.S. graduate, you can get licensed. And then you go on to further training, which is an additional 2 to up to 10 years, depending on whatever specialty you choose. So that would be at a minimum of 7 years if you wanted to obtain a board certification in a specialty. So this is in the next 2 years. That's the first question, then I have another question after that.
May not have time for that other question.
Okay.
Go ahead, Sarah.
Just in terms of these newly covered populations that young, you mentioned young adults, so potentially up to 2 million more young adults might be covered through this coming onto the parents' policies, I think the high-risk pools. So a few million more people, you know, with coverage in the next couple of years, which is a wonderful thing. And a lot of them are getting care at institutions that they're not able to pay for their care. So this will become a newly financed population. So to some degree, at least people who are now getting care at institutions that they're not able to pay for, that will become covered services. So that's one way, at least in terms of the financing, the dollars coming into the system. But Nira might have another.
I mean, I would say I did do a fair amount of work early in the administration on concerns about ensuring that we have enough doctors in the pipeline and healthcare professionals overall in the pipeline, because you know there is concerns that there are elements of our healthcare system where there are shortages, and obviously we will have 32 million more people covered. Now Sarah's point is exactly apt, which is not to say that these people often receive care, but it's not in the kinds of systems that we'd like, and it's also more expensive than we'd like, and that's one of the reasons why we wanted to ensure that we were covering people with insurance. So one of the great challenges is that it takes time to get doctors. There's a tremendous amount of training. So legislation does make particular efforts around doing that. There is, I think, one kind of the most important thing is better reimbursements around primary care to create the incentives for people to go into primary care over specialization. That was one of the big issues that we saw when we examined this debate, but I would say it's hard to do this, it's hard to recruit, and it's hard to build in the very short term. But we should recognize that we the greatest stress on the system won't be in the immediate time, because we won't be seeing large-scale increases in coverage. This, again, goes to Karen's point. This is the challenge of legislation. We will see expansions of coverage, but they will be relatively small in comparison to the big effort, which is in 2014. And so a lot of these proposals ramp up, but it's even going to be difficult to meet those specific targets in 2014 because it takes years to get people into the system. And realigning the incentives around reimbursement will be something that has impact over the long term.
And just the other, it's a yes or no question, is
smart.
preventive care, mm-hmm. although they're at the federal level, you know, we have issues as a nation in preventing certain issues, and we have a public health trust fund that's coming, that will be up.
Okay.
But my question is, will states, individual states, have a latitude in the direction of obtaining funds on addressing specific issues within those states that they want to prevent, like care or programs? Will the states mm-hmm. have the same amount of leverage as they do in obtaining funds, like, or they have, I don't know what the right term is, appropriation or oversight, such as in the Medicaid program of services within those states? Will they have that same amount of leverage within the states? Yes or no?
I think what's fascinating about the Public Health Trust Fund is it is tremendously flexible. And so, okay. I mean, it is designed to support a variety of things, including things at the very local level. And so I would imagine, I mean, this is something that we'll be continually working on, but I think the idea of it is that we'll be supporting, best efforts at the state level.
Okay.
Very good. We can handle another yes-no question, and that's about it. Can you be very brief?
I will be very brief. My name is Travoris Culpepper, and I'm with Teamsters Union. And a lot of our members have a lot of questions regarding the health care bill, and there was one particularly that stuck out to me. I mean, you might have answered this in the last question as it relates to coverage, but if an employee is employed with an employer and the employer is offering coverage, but their spouse opted to opt out of that coverage, what effect would that have on the employee and the employer, and if you expect any other, what is the fix to that?
Are you asking, would that trigger the penalty for?
Right.
I think the penalty is only if your employer offers coverage mm-hmm. and you are paying more than 9.5% of your income on premiums, or the value of your plan, the share of medical costs that's covered is less than 60%. Then you are eligible to go into the exchange and eligible for premium subsidies to the exchange. At that point, the employer would be fined either $3,000 for each worker who's in that situation or $2,000 for each worker in the company.
And that is applicable to the spouse as well?
Yeah, what if the employee stays in as an individual and the spouse, and they drop family coverage?
So the dependent.
Right.
I just don't mean, maybe Dean is grappling.
I think it's a good question, and maybe what we could do is I can tell you specifically if I can't find it right now. I think it actually does apply to the dependent, but let me check on it. And the other thing that would affect it, if the spouse, he or she, is just opting out, mm-hmm. presumably, in 2014, there would be shared responsibility. So presumably, not only would the employer have a responsibility to offer this affordable plan and could have a penalty if the dependent opts out, but also that dependent would have an income tax penalty if, in fact, they didn't.
That's right. I mean, that spouse does face the mandate.
Right.
Yeah. Okay.
The individual requirement.
I believe it's not just the employee, but it's anyone eligible under the employer's plan, which would include
right.
the dependent. If they don't meet those actuarial requirements that Sarah yeah. described, that the employer would have a penalty relative to that.
There's hardship exemptions, obviously, and
yeah, right.
as specified. But, mm-hmm. I mean, everyone faces that.
Okay.
Thank you. Well, that's a nice factual response to get us to the end of this. Let me just ask you once again, if you could take a moment to fill out those blue evaluation forms and remind you that we will be continuing this series that we've led off, I think, so brilliantly today, next Friday, and the two succeeding Fridays, taking up individual pieces of this. Thanks to the Commonwealth Fund for their participation and support. Thanks to you for asking good questions. And thanks for helping me to thank the panel for, I think, was a beautiful array of answers to difficult questions. Thank you.
Thank you so much.